Welcome to The Power of Stories, a podcast by women, about women, and for women. Their voices and their stories. I am Sharon Catherine D'Agostino, a passionate advocate for the empowerment of women and girls everywhere, and the founder of sayitforward.org.
And I'm Yodit Kifle-Smith, a creative dedicated to making sure the voices and stories of women are heard. I have the privilege of working with Sharon on sayitforward.org to do just that. In this podcast, you will meet courageous women from around the world whose unique path to empowerment will leave you encouraged and inspired. Today, we are so excited to have Dr. Shakira Chinara join us from her home in South Africa. Dr. Shakira is a public health activist and a passionate advocate for youth. Welcome, Shakira. We're so excited and thank you for making the time to be with us today on this podcast.
I think I'm even more excited than you, Yodit. And it's amazing to just catch in with you in at the beginning of 2021.
Yeah, no, we're excited. Welcome.
I'm so thrilled to be talking with you and, of course, with Yodit. You've won a number of very prestigious awards just over the last 3 years. I won't read the entire list, but the Mail and Guardian Top 50 Powerful Women in South Africa in 2018 and 2019, you were named in the list of the 100 most influential young Africans. And also in 2018, you were named one of the 100 future young Mandelas.
Wow.
That is so impressive. Tell us where your journey started that had you focus on activism and then become so successful at what you were doing.
You know, I'll gloss over the story because it's quite a painful one and it always brings me to tears, but it's also one that I'm so thankful for because I think it's really given me the purpose in life. And so I was quite young when I would accompany my father, who was visually impaired. I was about 12 or 13 years old, to the public healthcare system in South Africa. And I often joke that, you know, sometimes both my younger brother and I would accompany him because sometimes he would need medication, sometimes he would need to go see a physician, and we would split our tasks. My younger brother would go to one line and I would go to another. But I think I have a feeling my younger brother enjoyed missing school, whereas I didn't. I was very focused on trying to get an education. But nonetheless, it was when I saw what the public healthcare system was like. So when my father was first admitted for his heart condition, he was put in one of Southern Africa or Africa's largest hospitals. It's called Baragwana Hospital. And when he got there, they put him in a prison ward because there weren't any other beds available. So this was the ward essentially for prisoners. And now you're putting a visually impaired person in that ward. It's really difficult. And then when they left him at the bed that he was meant to spend the night on, it was essentially drenched in urine. And you know, there's no way that we could say, let's take him home and bring him back the next morning. So he had to spend the night in that ward. And there were many other instances of why or how the healthcare system was experienced. And so I realized at a very young age, I had witnessed these injustices. And it was something I wanted to change. But also linked to that, I mean, not being of a specific class in my community because my father was unemployed due to his visual impairment meant that I began to see how different classes are treated in a community, especially with my peers. And I sort of knew something was wrong. And then the third thing was growing up in South Africa, living in a community that the apartheid government sort of put us according to our races, and it continues until today, unless you can afford to move out of the area you were sort of allocated. And so, you know, living in a specific area with a specific race, but luckily and thankfully going to a school that was multiracial was exciting, because that's when I started to realize that race is such a big issue in the country. And it continues to be a big issue in the country. And you see it feeding into every part of South African society. And so those three things, you know, experiencing my dad at that public healthcare facility, and then also being from a lower class, essentially in inverted commas, and thirdly, you know, looking at the racial issues in South Africa, those are the three things which drive me every day. They're three big social justice issues that I've identified and which make me uncomfortable and which I want to change in some way.
The reality of inequities till this day is very prevalent. And, you know, I wonder at a young age, you mentioned racism and experiencing racism. Was there a time that truly defined you personally of having experienced racism personally?
Look, there's so many different childhood memories that I can think of. but the one that really comes to fore that just keeps me angry until today is, you know, one of my friends would drop me off at school. Well, I wasn't actually a child. I was actually a teen at that time. But this experience that comes to mind today was he was dropping me off after an exam at high school. And there were a couple of people in the community who said to me, how can you get in a car with a black man? And that's when I knew I don't fit into this place. I don't understand this place. It's so 18th century. How can you even ask me that in present day South Africa? So those are just one of the instances that sort of stand out in my mind. But I think, you know, either I've observed racism for others or myself as well. And it's really inherent in South Africa.
Issues of race and class, these are broad brush issues that many, many, many societies face, and we certainly face them in the US. In South Africa, how do you find ways to have your specific voice heard?
Look, there's different ways that this happens. So transformation is a very big element within the country since democracy in 1994. Almost every single institution is guided by these transformation policies, but they may also have mechanisms where you go and report these things. Of course, the problem is that there's a power dynamic attached. So you could go and report this, but it could mean losing your job. It could mean that you're reporting a senior who is the same senior who sits on a transformation committee. So it's like a chicken and egg situation. Outside of that, we've got the Human Rights Commission, where we're able to raise issues of racism. Unfortunately, they're overburdened. And by the time anything gets done, it's quite a long time. But what we've also seen recently, which I'm excited about, there are, you know, negatives and disadvantages, but what I'm excited about is in these past 2 years, there have been racists who have said that, you know, very negative things about Black people being at beaches in South Africa. Again, is this the 18th century? And what has happened is social media has caught on and citizens have put this on the table big time, leading to court cases against these racists. And so I think that's an interesting phenomena to see in South Africa. And then finally, through civil society organizations, such as the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation, which I'm part of, we try and create spaces to talk about racism in a very constructive manner, in a manner that's respectful, because sometimes the anger is easy to talk about. But it's even less easy to talk about truthfully and to do so in a way that takes us forward. So those are some of the different platforms that I can, you know, think about on the spot today.
Something that I've personally experienced is the issue of colorism, especially being from Ethiopia. There are various shades of Ethiopians and I'm on the lighter end. And I've also seen the way that lighter skinned Ethiopians view darker skinned Ethiopians. And so have you ever had to address in your own family issues of colorism?
Definitely. I mean, I don't think it's in one ethnic group. I think it's in almost every sort of racial group that we see. lighter women or lighter skin people are seen as more beautiful, more intelligent, you know, sought after for relationships and for marriage. And so I've seen it among my friends. I've seen it among my family, perhaps not my immediate family, but I could give you one example is when I was about to marry, you know, I had a cousin who actually asked me, what are your children going to look like? Because I'm sort of light skinned and my husband's darker skinned. And even if my husband and I walk into a restaurant, people tend to look at us in our racial group. He's seen as being sort of a lower class, lower echelon of society because of the color of his skin. And so, yes, not in my immediate family, but, you know, there have been more snide comments with extended family among my peer group as well, into people wondering, how on earth is Shakira marrying this man? And so it's a very interesting dynamic. And by the same token, you know, in not only my family, but in the racial group as well, what would happen is when, you know, people are getting married specifically, it seems to be a very big issue what skin tone color you are.
I read a piece that you wrote in January of 2021 called Loss and Renewed Purpose, The Experience of Shifting Identities. And in that, you talked about the fact that your identity was strongly linked to your career. And when you changed careers, you felt your identity shift. I believe this is a common occurrence for women as they take different directions in their life. Would you talk a bit about that?
I've always held very sort of high titled positions, very respected positions. And I think everybody in society assigns you the social status, this power and prestige based on your title. And so these titles become your identity. And as I mentioned, 2 years ago, I was in a job that was not fulfilling. It wasn't me. It wasn't what I wanted. And so I woke up one morning and I quit. And that was the first time I felt this loss of identity, as in, wow, you know, Shakira is officially not in any employment. And it was different. It was very weird. It was very strange because I think I had built my whole life around, or many of my hours were spent on health and in a specific position. And here I am with this slate to sort of craft my own destiny. And it was scary. It was scary in the sense that everyone you speak to asks, what is your affiliation? And I actually at one point said, I'm an independent. And they still ask, but what is your affiliation? And I'm like, I am an independent. What don't you understand? And so there isn't really a space for independent practitioners, really. But after 2 years, I began to find my feet and started to understand what this independent public health practitioner meant. But then I also became very aware of it's not just about that independent public health practitioner. It's what else are you? Who else are you? And I don't think I've discovered everything by a long shot. But, you know, it sort of gave me the perspective to say, what have I been suppressing? And I've been suppressing my creative side for very long. And so I pursued acting classes. And then I started to think about what else makes me up, you know? And so again, I don't think I've figured it all out. But I think that it was interesting because I think there's this pressure to always be in this high position in society. Whether it's among your peers, your colleagues, and your family. But it was nice to be able to say, if I can, screw that pressure. I'm now going to figure out really who I am. So it's been interesting to try and think of it outside of work as well.
You know, that's a journey that we are all on. So much of what you've said resonates with me. You said something when you mentioned that you were in a job that wasn't fulfilling you, and you said that wasn't me. And I love that because I don't think that there are many people recognize when something is just not them. So what was it that caused you to be able to say that? Like, this is not me. and then launched you to then step out?
I must be honest to those listening in. I'm not some kid with a big trust fund, so I couldn't just wake up and quit as well. I had to save enough to say I want to quit first. you know, so I was headhunted for this position. And it really seemed to be my dream job. Again, it was amazingly well paying. It was sold to me as running projects and being the head of advocacy and all of that. But at the end of the day, all I was doing was mundane tasks. And that's not me. I am not a mundane task person. I can do that for a component of my work, but I want to change the world. And every day getting up was harder and harder and harder. And I was more and more miserable to the point of, you know, people were just saying, no, but, you know, that's an amazing job. You're getting paid so much. Just do it. That's what my younger brother said to me, at least. And I said to him, maybe that's someone else, but it's not me. Money is not the only thing that drives a person. For me, coming from my background, it was incredible to be in this position to earn that much. But at the end of the day, I'm not driven by money. And I learned the hard way that money is not going to make you happy. And so that led to the realization. It was so funny when I told my boss I was quitting. She said, I'm so glad you are, because even I don't think this job fits you.
Shakira, among your many roles, you are a really consistent advocate for the empowerment of women and girls. How can we all, each of us, encourage other women and girls to confidently use their voice and claim their power?
It's simple. I think one is avoid the queen bee mentality that you're the center and the everything of everything. I mean, as much as I'm a person who puts myself out on social media and all of that, at the same time, I believe that it's simple to bring others along with you. You don't need loads of dollars and you don't need a big fancy program. If you're invited to a discussion, and I remember I did this at one conference for public health a few years ago. I was a keynote speaker and I was tired of being the keynote speaker all the time. And so I stopped my keynote and I said, I want a young woman to bring up a chair and come sit next to me. And she should speak, not me. And that was like a sort of like bold move to say to the organizers, enough of the same voices, you know. And so in anywhere or any place that we're given the opportunity, we should also think about, is there someone else who could benefit from it? So, for example, I don't apply for leadership programs anymore. I rather send them to other women I think who could benefit, unless it's something I really, really want to apply for. So I think that the moral of the story is that any opportunities you see or any opportunities you get, share them with others. It won't kill you, and it actually won't take away your limelight either.
Shakira, I've been so inspired by this conversation, and I'm sure our listeners have been too. So thank you so much for, again, taking the time to talk with us today and share a part of your story. And to our listeners, thank you for making the time to listen to this episode of the Power of Stories podcast.
Shakira and Yodit, I could talk to you for hours. Our time is up for today. I look forward to talking with both of you another time. And to our listeners, we invite you to visit sayitforward.org, a place where you are welcome to share one or more stories about your unique path to empowerment. Or you can read the stories of other women and girls. This is Sharon Catherine D'Agostino
and Yodit Kifley-Smith, signing off for now and hoping you'll join us for our next episode of the Power of Stories podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, we do hope you'll give us a review and recommend the Power of Stories to a friend. And lastly, we want to remind you of the power of your story.